Mahatma Gandhi was once introduced, and he, with a glowing introduction, he said, "I'm delighted with the introduction. I'd be even happier if it were true." But it really is a true honor for me to be invited to do this. I'm very grateful to the organizers to be named in the list of people like David Salisbury, Alan Hillman, Stan Plotkin, Walt Onstein, Sam Katz, Paul Offit, and Steve Kochi. It's truly an honor. Thank you so much. Now, most of my work was done on the Apache and Navajo Indian reservations that you see here. I want to go back. Okay. All right. This is a challenge. So you know that the that my people who introduced me didn't know my shortcomings. They only knew my positive things about me. So, but it, I worked on the Southwest for now 30 years. I was supposed to go out there just for 1 year. I was supposed to go back. The whole time I was trying to get to India. Columbus tried to get to India, and he ended up here. I tried to go to India, and I ended up here too. So we have this very similar history. When I first went to the Apache Indian Reservation, I wanted to go back to India and work on diarrhea. And one of my mentors had a project in Calcutta in India. And I was about to leave with my wife, and the Indo-Pakistan war broke out. They kicked out all U.S. projects from India. So they said, "Would you like to go to this Apache Indian Reservation for a year, and then you could go back to India?" So that 1 year is now 30 years. And when I arrived on the reservation, I don't know how many of you worked. I know that there are several people here who have worked on the reservation, but there's a lot of suspicion about foreigners. Especially they were very used to being exploited by white people, but they weren't quite sure what to make of this guy who was calling himself Indian. And I went up there and made this long speech about how this diarrhea was very important. It was a global disease. Many of their kids were dying. And I wanted to do this study, and there seemed to be no interest at all. They were just looking. And finally, the chairman of the tribe looked at me, and he said, "Now, Doc, are you going to take advantage of us just like all those white guys?" And I said, "Mr. Chairman, if Columbus had known his geography better, I would be living on a reservation. You'd be studying me." So with that, we became very good friends. Although we joke about Columbus, but when Columbus set out to go out to the reservations, to find India, his trip had to be financed, and he had to convince King Fernando, he wasn't that successful with King Fernando. He actually managed to convince Queen Isabel, who actually was a very ardent admirer of Columbus. And Columbus also had to get the blessings of the Pope at that time, because the Pope, as you all know, was very influential. And his line was that he was going to be able to bring back wealth that could be used to fight the Crusades so that Jerusalem can be taken over back from the Muslims. But I think we have not really advanced too much further on that within recent times. But when Columbus arrived, in his own journals, he says, they were welcomed by the Indian population. And Columbus himself says they were well-built with good bodies and handsome features. They do not bear arms and do not know them. But his response was that with 50 men, we could subjugate them. A lot of what we know about the early days of Columbus is from this individual, Las Casas, who's a Jesuit priest who accompanied Columbus to the Americas. And Las Casas was actually an ardent admirer of Columbus, but after he watched what was happening when Columbus and his crew got there, he became very disillusioned. These are some of his writings. He says, when the local chief learned that they were coming, he and up to 20 of his men came out of their town league in order to welcome them, presenting them with a great deal of food and supplies. The admiral was so anxious to please the king that he committed irreparable crimes against the Indians. And in a short time, this land, which was so great, so powerful and fertile, was depopulated. And I can tell you, I have many Indian friends, very close friends. This scar has stayed with the Indian people, and it's not going to go away soon. Las Casas goes on to say, while I was in Cuba, 7,000 children died in 3 months. Some others even drowned their babies in sheer desperation. Husbands died in the mines, wives died at work, and children died for lack of milk. Endless testimonies prove this mild and pacific temperament of the natives, but our work was to exacerbate, ravage, kill, mangle, and destroy. And he ends up by saying, my eyes have seen these acts so foreign to human nature, now I tremble to write. Who in future generations will believe this? I myself write it as a knowledgeable eyewitness can hardly believe it. With this background, I wanted to give you this background because people often say, isn't it difficult to work with American Indians? Aren't they difficult people? But you can see what has happened over the years. The health of the American Indian people was handed over to the War Department after the Indians were defeated because Indians were considered to be a security threat. In fact, the first measles, the smallpox vaccination, was provided to the Indians living around the forts so that the troops can be protected and they would not be infected. The Indian Removal Act is a very famous act, an act that the Indians very much resent even to today, an act to provide for exchange of lands with the Indian residing in any of the states or territories and for the removal west of the river Mississippi. And you can see what happened. It was the intention of the government to move the Indians out of the way so that the settlers can do their exploring. And one of my very good friends, Dr. Everett Rhodes, who some of you may know, former director of Indian Health Service, said, you know, one of the problems with the Indians is that their immigration policies were far too liberal. And that's why they don't have any land anymore. Now, this is the famous Trail of Tears that some of you may have heard of, where the Cherokee Indians were moved from Georgia all the way to Oklahoma. There was the long walk with the Navajos. These were very traumatic events, and I'm not going to go through some of the writings, but it affected these Indians terribly. There were old people, young people, and there are these graphic descriptions of how they moved across the country, and the writer goes on and says there were no sobs, no tears, all were silent, because it was a very emotional event. For the Indian, land is very important. Most of my friends will call it Mother Earth and Father Sky, because land, even today, and I'll show you later on, whenever there's any war, even today in the Iraq war, proportionately more Indians will volunteer to go and fight because protection of your land is very important. So you can see how traumatic this kind of thing must have been to the Indians. Now, there was a total disconnect between how the Indians felt and how the administration felt. Andrew Jackson considered himself to be a good friend of the Indians. He actually thought he was doing them a favor by moving them out of the East. This is his quote. He says, it gives me great pleasure to announce to Congress that the benevolent policy of the government in relation with the removal of the Indians beyond the white settlements is approaching a happy consummation. This is far from the truth if you read the writings of the Indian people. One of the other things that happened later on in the 19th century and even the early part of the turn of this century is that a lot of children were sent out to boarding schools. It was felt that somehow you must assimilate Indians and into the community, and this was done by people, well-meaning people. They were not trying to hurt Indians. They felt this is the best thing they can do for them. Teach them our religion, teach them our language, that way they'll get assimilated into society. And these were young kids were sent out, and they would have to wear Western clothes. They were not allowed to speak their language. They were punished if they spoke their language. I still have workers who work with me who are now in their 60s and 70s who went to these boarding schools and talk about the tremendous trauma they underwent. They would try on their clothes at night secretly. They would speak in Navajo at night if they were caught, they were punished. They were not fed and they were beaten. And there are many families that underwent this trauma. And this is a young, handsome Indian. You can see what happened to him when he was civilized, so-called. And there's also this stereotype about the Indians being obese, alcoholics, etc. Certainly that is a problem. The obesity is a major problem now. But that was not the way they were. They were hunters and gatherers. And you can see this is an artist picture of an Indian from the 15th century, tall, young person. In fact, Columbus himself observes, as soon as dawn came, many of these people came to the beach, all of them young, as I have said, all good stature, a very beautiful people. Their hair is not curly, but thick and flowing like a horse's mane. And this is what I was telling you about. These are the Navajos who volunteered during the Second World War. Many of you may have heard of the Code Talkers. There was also a movie about this. They are credited with having a significant role in winning the war against the Japanese. And some of these Code Talkers are still alive. This gentleman, Arthur Hubbard, is the grandfather of this young lady, Olivia Sloan, who now works for me. Olivia is a brilliant young Navajo. whom I've had the opportunity to mentor, that these brave men still tell wonderful stories about the Second World War, and we all owe a great deal of debt to these men. Now, as I told you, land is extremely important to the American Indian people. President Franklin's peers actually tried to buy land back from Chief Seattle. And this is what Chief Seattle wrote back to him, and this is just an excerpt. It says, "How can you buy or sell the sky, the warmth of the land? The idea is strange to us. Every part of this earth is sacred to my people. We are part of the earth, and it's part of us. The perfumed flowers are our sisters, the deer, the horse, the great eagle. These are all our brothers." It's a great deal of respect for environment, for the animal kingdom and the bird kingdom. It was a tremendous learning experience for me and my family when we lived out on the reservation. Now I'm going to move to some of the biomedical thing contributions that they've made. Now there have been, historically, many epidemics have been documented, just about every infectious disease, smallpox, measles, cholera, you name it. But all of this was imported by the colonizers. The only disease that we have good evidence for that existed before the colonizers arrived was tuberculosis. From exhumed bodies, there's good evidence that TB actually existed before the settlers arrived. One of the major contributions is the treatment of trachoma. You know, trachoma was the leading cause of blindness. It still is an important cause of blindness. The initial trials with sulfonamides were conducted among American Indian populations. Another vaccine that we all take for granted, the initial BCG trial was conducted by Dr. Aronson and this group in four Indian reservations across the United States. This is Joseph Aronson. He randomized individuals. This is one of the early randomized trials in 1930. He randomized children and adults to receive BCG or a placebo. An extraordinary story that I have to tell you about this. Around 10 years ago, his granddaughter, Naomi Aronson, who now works for the Walter Reed Hospital, walked into my office and said, "I'm Naomi Aronson, granddaughter of Dr. Aronson, who did the BCG study. I have the original punch cards that my grandfather used." He said, "Would you be willing to help me to do a 60-year follow-up of this cohort?" And I just didn't say anything. But she convinced me that it could be done. We, in fact, did it. And there is a 60-year-old follow-up that's been published in JAMA by Naomi, and there's still 52% efficacy. It was a very interesting study trying to get consents from dead people. So quite. The other major contribution, one in which that I was quite involved in, is diarrheal diseases. As you all know, diarrheal diseases continue to be a major cause of mortality in children around the world. For most of us as adults, we usually have to worry about it when we're traveling, traveler's diarrhea, and I can tell you these rooms don't usually help you. These doors usually don't work when you need them. And most of us don't get this dehydrated, but dehydration is the major problem. But among children, dehydration is still a major problem. Many children around the world die. And the simple solution, oral rehydration solution, these packets, have saved millions and millions of lives over the years. And one of the places where all of this started was in the White Mountain Apache Reservation. You know, the diarrhea mortality when I started, when I was working with the Apache Reservation was about 5 million, and it's now down to about 1.9 to 1.5. There's still a lot of deaths occurring, but over this period, millions and millions of lives have been saved. The Lancet said oral radiation therapy is potentially the most important medical advance of this century. And as for those of you who worked on developing countries, you know that transportation is a major problem. Unfortunately, in places like Bangladesh, this is still true. And anyone who's managed a case of cholera knows that there's no way in the world that in developing countries you can continue to manage these cases with IV fluids alone. So there was a tremendous interest in developing countries to come up with an alternate method of treating children. In fact, this is an example of reverse transfer of technology. But actually, a lot of the work on oral rehydration started out in developing countries and a developing region within the United States on the Apache Indian Reservation. And this was a very common scene. And if you have to if you're supposed to use disposable tubing and you don't have any replacement, you then recycle the same thing. And you can imagine all the problems we had with nosocomial infections. I think almost nobody in this room is old enough to remember this. These are diarrhea wards that we all used to see when we went around the world. And you can imagine in this kind of situation, there's usually one nurse trying to keep up with all of these IV fluids, and there's no way you can manage nosocomial infection. You just keep passing infection back and forth. And isolation techniques don't really work very well in this situation. And people, where's my water? Can I have my water? Thank you. And people got very frustrated. And when I went to the Apache Indian Reservation, there were a lot of kids who would come in with severe dehydration. Many of them died. Some of them were able to save. I would point out to you that I did have hair when I got there. Some of my Apache friends said, be careful, we might scalp you. And they did. But this was a tragic scene that I had to face many, many times. We lost many kids. I buried many kids when I got there. We were able to save a few of them. But thankfully, within 2 or 3 years after we got there, we were able to demonstrate the use of oral rehydration therapy on this population. And by the time, by about 4 or 5 years afterwards, there have been no deaths from diarrhea in this population. And the person who inspired me to do this work is Harold Harrison, who some of you may have heard. He was at the Baltimore City Hospitals. He was the father of fluid and electrolyte balance. He had actually tested an oral rehydration solution in Baltimore back in 1946. Unfortunately, even though Harold Harrison had shown that the solution works very well, a commercial company decided to commercialize it and make money from it, which is fine, but they dispensed it in a bottle. Mothers were given a bottle with sodium and chloride and bicarbonate, and they were asked to take a tablespoon of it and mix it with a liter of water. If you tell a mother that a tablespoon is good for your child, of course 2 tablespoons better than one, and 3 is better than 2. There were many cases of hypernatremia that were reported around the country because of this misunderstanding. Of course, this is the worst case of hypernatremia that's ever been reported in the world. And we have never seen one this bad. So when I got there, there was a lot of concern about oral rehydration therapy. We were all taught as pediatricians, do not give solutions that contain high sodium. So I spent the next 4 to 5 years working on oral rehydration solution. I realized that on the Apache Reservation, we cannot manage all these kids with IV fluids because many of them wouldn't get to the hospital. They would die. And so we were able to demonstrate this, and these lessons were taken by WHO and used in many countries around the world. The other thing that was happening was not only would kids die from acute diarrhea, they would get repeated episodes of diarrhea. And that they would, with each episode, they would lose weight. And the standard teaching for many of us in the 70s and 80s was that when you have diarrhea, you rest the gut. We used to give, in Hopkins, I think, Jeannie, we taught you to give clear fluids, right? In fact, the textbook of pediatrics, if you read the last 2 lines, says when you have a child has diarrhea, you rest the gut for 7 to 8 days. A child in Bangladesh or in Africa has no chance if you rest the gut for 7 to 8 days. This child is already undernourished, the child is already not eating, and the child's going to have 8 to 10 episodes of diarrhea each year. So we actually conduct, and when I would ask people, why do we do this? What is the evidence? They said, well, this is what we do. This is what we've been taught to do. So I often think about, what are we teaching people now? It says half of what we teach you here is wrong, but unfortunately we don't know which half. And I often think about that when I'm on rounds with people, and what am I teaching that's wrong right now? So we did a study on the Apache Indian Reservation where we randomized kids to either get feeding immediately after rehydration, which we did within 4 hours, compared to standard therapy at that time, which was to starve, not give the kid any food at all for 48 hours. Then you gave dilute milk, and then you gave, it took about a week to come back to full feeding. But when we did that, we were able to show that the duration of diarrhea was reduced by about 40%. And also the stool output reduced dramatically. Not only did we not make the diarrhea worse, we were able to show there was significant advantage. And this lesson was taken all around the world by WHO. And the diarrhea mortality just dropped dramatically, and now, in fact, there have been no deaths from diarrhea, as far as I know, in the last few years on the Indian Reservation. Now, while I was doing this work, I arrived there in 1980, and within a 3-month period, there were 5 cases of invasive hip disease that occurred. And I'd worked with Richard Moxon, who many of you know, and I knew that the rates of Haemophilus influenzae disease in Baltimore was somewhere in about 20 to 40 per 100,000. This translated to a rate of something like over 1,000, 1,500 per 100,000, which I thought maybe was a fluke. So we did a 10-year retrospective review and discovered that not only did Apaches have very high attack rates, and I did not know the literature at that time. I didn't know anything about Haemophilus influenza, and also then read the literature and found out that the Alaska natives also have very high attack rates of HIP disease. So if you want to do anything about any disease, you actually, on the reservation, you have to go to the tribal council and ask them permission or ask them what they want to do. So I went to the tribal elders, the tribal council, and said, do you realize you have a problem called meningitis? And to my surprise, they all said, yes, we do know that. Many of our children have died, and some of our children have suffered severe consequences. They said, well, have you thought about doing anything about that? I said, well, we don't know what to do. You're from Johns Hopkins. Tell us what to do. So I felt somewhat like this, you know, just when I figured out all of life's answer, they changed all the questions. So literally, I had to call around the country to find the best experts in the field. I called my friend Richard Moxon, who was still at Johns Hopkins at that time, and there was no product available. The only product that was even being tested was the pure polysaccharide vaccine that was tested in Finland, was shown to be efficacious in children about 2, but not efficacious in children below 2. There's an individual called George Sieber, who many of you know, who worked at the Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. He had used a product called bacterial polysaccharide immune globulin. This was a hyperimmune globulin that was developed by immunizing adult volunteers with Haemophilus influenzae vaccine, bleeding the globulin fraction, and then you have a globulin that's highly enriched for Haemophilus influenzae. So I wanted to use that product on a compassionate basis. So George said you have to call FDA. I called FDA, said you cannot use it unless it is done under IND. So I thought if we're going to do an IND, we might as well do a randomized trial, which is what we did. And we were able to show that this product, the bacteria, oh, sorry, what did I do? I hit something and it disappeared. Can you help me? Can you get back to where I was? Oops, okay, that's okay, I can get there. I'm technologically challenged. Yeah, just to make sure. How many of you remember these slides? almost there. Sorry about that. Okay, so we were able to show that this particular product worked well. There were 7 cases in the placebo group versus 0 in the bacterial polysaccharide group. The problem was this: we had to give this particular, since it's passive immunization, we had to give repeated doses every 3 months, and it cost $100 a dose. But in addition to that, we had to give large volumes, which the babies didn't like, just like 0.5 cc's per kilo. So that wasn't really the answer. Fortunately for us, by then, the new generation of conjugate vaccines became available for testing. So we tested all the different conjugate vaccines, and the one vaccine that produced a good immune response after a single dose was the PRP-OMP, or the PEDVAX-HIP, as it's known now. And we decided to do a double-blind placebo-controlled trial because there was no efficacy data at that time. We tested all these different vaccines. And the rationale was that there was a very high proportion of, not only did Apache Indians have very high rates of Haemophilus influenzae disease, it occurred at a very young age. A very high proportion occurred in children below 6 months of age. And it was the only vaccine that produced a good immune response after a single dose. Now you can imagine the Apache reservation, Navajo reservation, this group is already very suspicious about researchers, and we wanted to do a double-blind placebo-controlled trial. It's a very traditional community. They have these very traditional dances called sunrise dances. When the girl comes of age, there's dancing that goes on all very early, starting very early in the morning, goes on all the way to evening. And the food sits out at 100 degrees temperature. And it was great for me because I was doing diarrheal disease research at that time. So, but, and they have these traditional dancers. Now, they also have a very great, they have elders who have to approve everything. This is the health board that has to approve it. Most of the time, they approved it because they trusted me as a person, not because they necessarily understood all the intricacies of the research. They also have a tremendous sense of humor, and one of them said, no, Doc, I really understand the reason why you need a control group, but then we're very concerned that the other group is going to be completely out of control here. Anyway, they did allow us to do the study. And I'll just summarize the data very quickly. The efficacy was very high. In children below 15 months of age, there was 100% efficacy. And what was even more exciting, we gave, the PEDVAXIB, many of you know, is a two-dose vaccine, 2 months and 4 months. In that two-month period, there were 8 cases in the placebo group and none at all in the vaccine group. So this vaccine started protection with a single dose. This was a great advance at that time, especially for the Indian population. And this was when we broke code. And you see, I still had hair at this point, too. So when we broke code, this is the first time we had heard about the results of this trial. And you can see, once we introduced the vaccine, that the disease disappeared very quickly. And we now know that these conjugate vaccines induce herd immunity. And I had not paid attention to Trudy Murphy's study, which she had published here long before my study, where she, in a daycare center, demonstrated that vaccinating older children, you could actually reduce disease carriage in younger infants. And we now know that this vaccine produces not only protection in the individuals who are immunized, but also a very strong herd immunity. In 2003, there was a large meeting in Scottsdale, Arizona, where people from all around the world came to talk about Haemophilus influenzae disease. And there was one of the major presentations was from the Navajo, Apache, and Alaska reservations. I'm now going to talk about rotavirus. You all know that we all use Rotatec now. I do want to point out that rotavirus, no matter where you are, rotavirus is a leading cause of diarrhea. Roger Glass calls it a democratic disease. It affects all populations. But the difference is, in developing countries, there's a very high mortality. Even though we have same rates of disease here, because of our access to healthcare, most of our children don't die. One of the first vaccine trials that was conducted with the first generation rotavirus vaccines was conducted on the Navajo Indian Reservation. It was called RIT, and the original rhesus rotavirus vaccine, the predecessor to RotaShield. We conducted the trial, and there was absolutely no efficacy. In 1992 to 94, we conducted the RotaShield trial, and there was 50% efficacy for all rotavirus diarrhea and 69% for severe diarrhea, very similar to what the multicenter U.S. trial showed. And you all know about the intussusception problem. Even though this was licensed, this was a great disappointment. This was the second, my first trial failed because it didn't work. My second trial worked, but it was withdrawn. So this was my third attempt. We then decided to participate in the Rotatrek trial, which is a multi-center trial involving many countries. But we wanted to be sure that this vaccine, even though we participated in the multi-center trial, we negotiated with Merck so that we'd have enough sample size in order to demonstrate efficacy in the Navajo Apache population. We felt that was very important because of the differential immunoresponses with the native populations. And you all know the results of the Rotatec trial was 88% efficacious and 98% efficacious for severe disease. Fortunately, when we looked at the efficacy of the rotavirus Rotatec in our population compared to the multi-center trial across the different countries, it was identical. So the vaccine seemed to work extremely well. The other major contribution is work on pneumococcus. We were one of the sites to conduct the first Prevnar trial. While we were conducting Haemophilus trials, we discovered that the rates of pneumococcal disease are also very high in this population. Kate O'Brien was leading the effort on the pneumococcal vaccine trials with us. As you all know, the challenges are much greater, with greater than 90 serotypes. The Prevnar that we currently use covers about little over 50% of the serotypes on the Navajo Apache Reservation and in most developing countries, whereas it covers 85 to 90% of the disease in the general U.S. population. In this trial, we were able to demonstrate that this vaccine was, for vaccine-type disease, was 86% efficacy. But because a much smaller proportion of the disease is caused by vaccine serotypes, the overall impact is less on the Navajo Apache Reservation. And this trial has now been extended. Several other trials have now been conducted in South Africa, in Gambia, in California, and all of them show that this vaccine works extremely well. This has been an extraordinary vaccine. These are slides that I borrowed from Cindy Whitney, and you can see the impact on vaccine-type disease has been tremendous. And what is even more exciting is that the herd immunity effect and the dramatic drop in disease in the elderly for individuals above 80, there's 90% efficacy when you vaccinate the young children. I don't know of any other vaccine that can do that. I'm going to finish up by talking about RSV disease, which we've just been conducting recently. Almost every infectious disease that we have looked at in the American Indian population, the rates are extremely high, and we don't quite understand why this is. We were able to show, and the group from Alaska have been able to show, that the rates of RSV disease, this is not the high-risk premature babies, just the normal newborn babies, is much higher on the Navajo Apache population and Alaska Native populations. And you all know that Synagis is recommended routinely for high-risk populations. There is a new product that MedImmune has produced, which is called Mortavizumab, which is supposed to be 74, which has 74 increase in binding to RSV. We have just in the midst of finishing up this trial, and we were able to show that this compared to placebo, there's 83% reduction in disease. We excluded individuals who are eligible for Synagis because we obviously couldn't randomize them. This product will probably be licensed sometime later this year and will also become part of the routine management for high-risk kids. We're hoping that will become a recommendation for Navajo, Apache, and Alaska Natives also. Again, a major contribution. It does take five doses of Synagis, and this new product will also have to be given five times. I just want to end up by thanking our staff. It's obviously these things can't be done with one individual, but there are over 100 staff on the reservation, and they are ably guided by Kate O'Brien, who's doing most of the work now. She's head of the infectious disease group for us, and she's ably assisted by Jean Millar and Aruna Chandran, who works with us. And I also want to thank the mothers and the little babies. You know, these little cradle boards, as they call them, form wonderful papoose boards for us. We just pull out the arm and draw blood from these babies. And this is an extraordinary story. I was visiting Chinle. I don't know how many of you have been to Canyon de Chelly. I was having a dinner at this place, and our project director there said, you know, this family would like to talk to you. And I said, sure, happy to talk to them. And they said, you know, we want to thank you because each one of our children have been in one of your studies. The oldest one has been on the HIV study, the next one on the pneumo study, and the last one is now on the RSV study. We have now started a Center for American Indian Health, and besides infectious disease, there are also behavioral issues, mental health issues, alcoholism, injuries, and training is a very, very important part of our effort. And these are American Indians who are trained under us. We provide scholarship to them. Many of them have now gone on. We have one who's gone on to medical school, one who's gone to law school. We have one going to dental school. And when I first got there, hardly any of these young people would even finish high school. Now we've graduated many of them, and they come back and work with us, and it's just a very fulfilling thing. I also want to thank CDC because I've had the opportunity to mentor several of the people sometime during their career. And I have to say, a lot of times the mentoring went the other way. They taught me more than I ever taught them. Kate O'Brien, you have already heard about. Rich Besser came to me as an intern and said, I'd like to follow a career in international health. Can you give me some guidance? Margaret Cortez, when she was a senior resident, came and said, I would like to go out to the reservation. Do you have any opportunities? And James Swart worked with me on the HIP trial. And Orin Levin, who came to us as a master's student, went on to do PhD. Now the director of Pneumo ADEP, he's had an extraordinary career. He's been instrumental in pushing the whole Pneumo agenda forward, and also been instrumental in the advanced market commitment, where we've been able to raise over $1.5 billion for pneumococcal vaccines. Now these people don't necessarily need my help. They are very bright young people, and my contribution mainly was to make sure that they aim high and far. And you can tell that most of them have aimed and far. You know, When I look at these bright young people, I'm reminded of this quote by William Osler to William Welsh. He said, "Welsh, it's lucky that we got in as professors. We would never have entered as students." I can attest to that because I could not get in. I applied to Johns Hopkins for internship. They turned me down. And you all at CDC turned me down when I applied for EAS officer. So I thought I would get in as the Maurice Hilleman lecturer. I will wrap up now. William Osler was obviously a visionary. He said pneumonia is the captain of all deaths, and all of us can relate to that. We all know about AIDS, diarrhea, TB, and malaria, but people forget ARI causes 3.5 million deaths and 1.8 million deaths on children below 5 years of age. And a lot of these deaths occur in the poorest countries. And unfortunately, until recently, most of the vaccination is given in the richest countries, and all the deaths are in the poorest countries. And part of the reason for this disconnect is that we as scientists don't often communicate well with the decision makers. Here's somebody who's fishing and sees this person in a balloon and says, this guy says, "Where am I?" He says, "You're 30 meters above the ground in a balloon." He says, "You must be a researcher." She says, "Yes, but how did you know?" He says, "Because what you told me is absolutely correct, but completely useless." He says, "You must be a policymaker." He says, "Yes, how did you know?" He says, "Because you don't know where you're going, you don't know where you are, you don't know where you're going, and now you're blaming me." But thanks to Pneumo-Aedip and people like Oren Levine, now pneumococcal vaccine is getting introduced in many countries. Another big success story is the HIB initiative, which Rana Hajay has been leading. You know, when this project started out in 2003, only 18% of the Gavi-eligible countries used the HIB vaccine. Now, about over 70% are using it. And by the time this project is over by next year, we think that we can get almost 100% of the Gavi-eligible countries to use the vaccine. You know, Martin Luther King said, "I have a dream that my four children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character." And I personally have a dream that one day every child will receive this new vaccine, not based on their country's income, not based on their parents' income, but based on the fact that the child needs it. So let me end by this traditional Navajo blessing: "With beauty before me, there may I walk. With beauty behind me, there may I walk. With beauty above me, there may I walk. With beauty all around me, there may I walk. In beauty, it is finished." Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for your tremendous efforts and for that tremendous talk. There's time for some questions if people are interested in asking them. Inspire them.
I think people want to eat, right?
Okay.
Well, thank you.
That looks like he answered all your questions. Okay, but thank you again for all of you for coming, and thank you very much, Dr. Sanchez.
If you could hold just a minute. Each year, the Hilleman Lecture honors an individual for their contribution to preventing disease through immunization. And Dr. Santosham, you're our honoree this year, so I'd like to present you with a certificate. Thank you so much for a fantastic presentation, and congratulations.
Thank you very much. Thanks.